This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 21st of June 2014 on Monocle 24.
Boots on, socks up and ready for kickoff. Punchy penalties in the headlines, talking tactically in the columns from kits to coaches. The world's printing presses are going football mad. As the World Cup in Brazil gets into full swing, we take a look at the world of football in print. What makes for a brilliant back cover? How do fans digest the vital statistics? And what lies ahead for football journalism? We review some very sporty special editions of titles that are new ground for football. We'll also have a look at the World Cup issue of one title renowned for bringing a fashion element to the sport. The editor of the Green Soccer Journal will be in studio, and he'll be joined by a leading football journalist and broadcaster. Plus, we'll be going to Italy, where one sporting title is still very much a print institution.
In almost every bar in Italy, we sell, I think, something like 70,000 copies every day. So you drink a coffee, read the newspaper. It's a tradition.
All that and plenty more besides today on this World Cup special of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards, standing in for Tyler Brulé, and today we're talking football. You've probably noticed that there's something of a global gathering taking place in Brazil just at the moment. There appears to be no escaping the World Cup finals, in part because of the voracious appetite of readers around the world for great coverage, writing pictures and analysis of the action. I used to work on the sports desk of the Independent newspaper here in London, so I like to think I know a little bit about the business of football in print. And I could not be joined by two more capable people for this flight over football fare in print than my two guests today. Adam Toll is the co-founder, editorial and creative director of the Green Soccer Journal. The Green Soccer Journal is a biannual magazine that takes an innovative, cultured and intelligent approach to the world's most popular sport. Uniting sport and style, the journal's been at the forefront of changing the look and feel of publishing for men here in the UK. Welcome back to The Stack, Adam. My next guest is Ben Littleton. Ben's a journalist, broadcaster, who's already written about the World Cup for Time magazine, Sports Illustrated, The Financial Times, Times of India, amongst others, and is the author of the book 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty. Ben, welcome to you too. I'd like to kind of take you both back to the beginnings, actually, before we talk about the developments in print and the new issue of The Green and things like that. Your early memories then of consuming football media, Ben, were you a sort of a fanzine person? Did you read like Shoot and Match, or were you, I could imagine maybe you were straight onto the back of the broadsheet. So where did your footballing journalism begin for you?
Well, I appreciate your high expectations of my intellect as a young child at age about 8. No, it was Match and Shoot, because, you know, when I was at school, that was the easiest digestible magazines there were, that developed then into titles like 90 Minutes, Goal magazine, Match of the Day magazine, Total Football, which I ended up working on. And this is the mid-90s, when we didn't really consume football on the internet, and magazines were the only way we could get extra. And there were loads of magazines. So there aren't really now, or at least if they are, they're of a different type, like the Green Soccer Journal. And then, of course, when the World Cup came along, it was Panini sticker albums.
I think we might talk a bit more about Panini albums a bit later. Adam, what about you? Because obviously it's funny now, I guess you're sort of presiding over this footballing monolith that is the Green Soccer Journal. Did you sort of have an inkling from a young age that that's what you'd be doing? Were there things that sort of piqued your interest, the kind of titles that Ben mentions? Or was your inspiration from somewhere else, perhaps?
There wasn't any specific titles I used to read when I was younger about football. There was always, I'm going to have to tell this story again, because it's basically why we called the Green Soccer Journal the Green Soccer Journal. There was a newspaper that was published in Derby, where I'm from, and they used to publish I'm sure every city and town has one, but this was called The Sporting Green. And I was completely obsessed by this publication. It was by 6 o'clock, it had all these results published and all these league tables finalised, and it was just before the internet. That speed of getting all that information onto print and in my hands within, you know, an hour. And that was kind of my education with print and football in general.
I just wonder, I mean, we'll probably talk about this a bit more later. Ben, you alluded to it in your first answer. Well, in fact, you just explicitly said it, how the landscape's been changed by by digital. Has it been good? Because I know obviously you work in broadcast, you're very interested also in the statistical side of the game, and a lot of the digital outlets have been, were very much in the vanguard of addressing those areas and bringing them to the masses. So they've obviously done a good job in some respects, but has it compromised, do you think, the traditional, I don't know, quality football writing, or has it actually given a platform to more people to be able to get their own views on the game out there?
It's really interesting. I think we're seeing, if not a backlash to the digital revolution in terms of how sport and football specifically is covered, we are seeing a different way that it is being represented with titles like the Green Soccer Journal, but also in long form writing. So we're seeing much more long form writing than we were even 4 years ago. Titles like The Blizzard have come in since then, but also ESPN magazine have sent Wright Thompson off for the last year to do huge pieces, like Hemingway-esque reportage pieces on Luis Suarez. He spent like a month drinking with the locals in Montevideo to try and find the referee that Suarez was supposed to have headbutted when he was 15 years old.
I don't quite like to get an assignment like that.
Well, it actually got the mafia involved and there were more hits
maybe
involved.
Maybe not then.
It was quite scary. I'm not sure it's up your street, Tom. But he went to Bosnia to spend time in the village that Vedad Ibisevic grew up in and was destroyed. And, you know, Ibisevic scored the goal for Bosnia and Herzegovina against Argentina. So all these amazing long-form pieces are making some kind of a comeback. And I think that is a definite reaction to the social media revolution where everything is in 140 characters. It's much harder to get an exclusive because once you get an exclusive story, you put it out on Twitter, it gets retweeted 10 times, and the story then basically does not become yours anymore. And that is a big problem for the newspapers. It's harder for them to get exclusives, and it's harder for them to hold on to exclusives, because it's not a question of publishing the paper in the morning. We all see it for the first time at 8 o'clock in the morning and think, wow, all day, this is their story, this belongs to them. It gets tweeted out at 4 o'clock in the afternoon or 10 o'clock at night, and within 10 minutes, every newspaper is covering it. And it's very, very difficult for them. So that's why I think this new form of long-form journalism is really interesting and I think a very positive step.
Let me just ask you, Adam, about that with Degree. I mean, how aware are you then of that sort of proprietary quality over your journalism? How difficult, I suppose, is it to deal with all of the conflicting interests because you've got players and their representatives, all the various commercial concerns and considerations you have to make?
I think over time we've managed to find the right balance between dealing with the creative process and the commercial process. You know, we obviously have to work with the brands in order to get access, and obviously we have to deal with the creative that they present. You know, they want to sell boots, they want to sell football shirts, but we want to tell stories at the same time. And the way we do that is by putting creative together, which, you know, appeases the brands. We always shoot the cover with a football shirt. You know, it's an iconic look anyway. We're happy to do that. We wouldn't want to stray from that process. But then we've got the sort of long form interviews, profile pieces. And also we've got three different sections to the magazine now where we've got the shorter pieces which kind of appeal to people who don't have the sort of time to, I don't know how much time people get anymore. So we kind of have, we catered for that with the shorter pieces, the longer profile pieces, and then a more longer form essay at the back.
And what about on the printed page, I guess the traditional form of sports coverage, Ben, which would be in a sort of newspapers, because the marketplace is constantly contracting, not just here, but this is a global trend. And obviously at Monocle, we're very keen on following, you know, the arch exponents, the great people who do the job well on the printed page. But there are fewer and fewer good news stories. Where they're good, they're great, of course. Does it worry you as a, you know, as a journalist, first and foremost, I guess, to see those, not just potential sources of revenue, but those sources of inspiration drying up? Or do you think that there are enough really good people who are still running great sports sections, enough proprietors perhaps of newspapers who still really know what they're doing, that you don't sort of despair about the future?
I mean, it depends what market you're talking about, because the market in England is very unique in a way, because across Europe, you have newspapers that are dedicated to sport and usually mostly football. If there are 24 pages in a sporting newspaper, 22 of them will be about football in L'Equipe, in the Spanish press, in Italy with Gazzetta and all these other sporting newspapers. And in England, it's not that. Sport basically sits on in the back pages of a normal newspaper. And that's quite rare. And the sports editors do have a challenge, because they obviously want more pages, more space. And at the World Cup, they are getting their own supplements, but it's still a supplement within an existing title.
I'm going to ask you about those sort of supplements, particularly when other magazines, other papers sort of dip their feet into the footballing world and the success or otherwise of their efforts to do it. But just on that sort of editorial front, Adam, I wondered, where do you take your
inspiration from then? Obviously, you're a magazine aficionado, and so you'll look at titles across fashion, sport, lifestyle, all sorts of things. Does the traditional footballing press still inspire you, or do you look more to your magazine rivals when you're actually considering, you know, what's going to happen in the next issue of The Green?
I honestly don't follow any other football magazine. I just don't have an interest in publishing from that angle, and that's just me personally speaking. You know, and like you said, we do take our inspiration from titles that perhaps don't cover sport at all, you know, like Fantastic Man or O32C or, you know, even Monocle. Those kind of titles are an inspiration to us when we're building a strategy or a structure for editorial. Then, of course, there's magazines like The New Yorker. You know, I'd love to have the freedom to do a bigger ESPN-type piece with those Suarez characters, but unfortunately, you know, we're a small publication still, and that time is not afforded to us just yet.
And just briefly, in terms of, I think we talked about this before when you were on the stack, in terms of how the football world and the fashion worlds have engaged with you, do you find it's become easier now as you've kind of cemented your reputation somewhat? Do people find it easier to sort of see where you're coming from? Because I think in the early days, there was still that sort of challenge where maybe people are too ready to try and pigeonhole. So is this actually a football magazine, or is this a fashion title? Have you managed to reconcile that, or get other people to reconcile it, do you think?
I think it's understood better. You know, we don't have to pitch what we are in 1,000 words anymore. It's much easier to explain because visually it's all there on the pages. It's still not easier to get the time with the players. I mean, they're not interested in sitting and doing a fashion shoot.
I can think of a few who surely would be, no?
Yeah, the ones, we don't really approach those ones though because it just seems quite obvious to us. But, you know, Casillas, for example, is a purist footballer. He you know, he alludes to it in the piece that Dermot Corrigan's written about how, you know, he understands that that comes with the job, that comes with the territory. He has to do his media work. But first and foremost, he remembers that he's a footballer. And I think it kind of comes across in the shoot. You know, when we did Podolski, he's a little bit show-off. And I think that comes across in sort of the imagery that we presented within the pages. And he just seemed to enjoy it better than Casillas did.
We'll delve into the stack of magazines that we have here. But Ben, just as a last thought on that, I wonder when there's players in the past, perhaps you've been speaking to, where you maybe thought, if only there was a magazine that dealt with fashion and football, that would probably be the place, Sonny, where you belong. There's sometimes some players you think actually do suit that kind of coverage, even if it's maybe a little left field, a bit of a different way of approaching the subject matter.
I think if you had a player like Raheem Sterling, who is not very experienced but has an interesting backstory, and say to him, right, we're going to do a fashion shoot and build the interview around what you're wearing, he is much more likely to open up. Someone like that is much more likely to open up than if you do a pure interview and say, right, we're going to talk about football. What do you think about when you're dribbling at players? Where do you get your instinctive game intelligence from? These questions are difficult for players to talk about anyway, but when you build it around another narrative, it's often a lot easier for them to open up.
You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. A short break now, then we'll be heading to Milan and to the offices of the Gazzetta dello Sport.
The numbers have been crunched, the editors have deliberated. Now we can unveil who came top in our 2014 survey of the best cities to call home. You'll discover the risers and fallers and a few new entries in our July-August summer double issue. It also includes a 28-page travel guide to South Tyrol, the Italian Alpine province, where you're as likely to hear the locals speaking German and where great hotels, bars and restaurants fill every cute town. And there's more. In the design section, we head to Auckland to see how a recently rejuvenated works depot in the middle of the city has provided a new home for the city's creative class. And then from bridges in Berlin to baths in Budapest, we discover some of the world's most charming gathering points and also pick out 10 of the best urban details from knobs in Valencia to manhole covers in Japan.
In the edit section, we head to a venerable old market in Porto. Not only has the Mercado de Bilbao put food on the city's tables for the past century, its ongoing importance goes to show that bigger and shinier don't always mean better. We also explore three inner city enclaves offering an agreeable quality of life from Taipei to London and Santiago.
Monocle's July-August double issue is on newsstands around the world now, or get yourself a subscription at monocle.com.
With its iconic pink pages, its ubiquitous daily presence in the bars and cafes of a football-mad nation, the Gazzetta dello Sport is a sports newspaper like no other. With a circulation of around 400,000, it's also one of Europe's most read dailies. As the World Cup action in Brazil heats up, our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, went out to investigate the significance of the Gazzetta in Italian life.
To say Italians love football is an understatement. Three national sports dailies put out editions each day to satisfy locals' appetites for the game. Leading the way is La Gazzetta dello Sport. Founded in 1896, it's the nation's most widely read newspaper. It stands out not only for the pink paper it is printed on, but the creative ways it covers every facet of football. While it features all sports, it has a team of 45 journalists assigned to follow football to feed a public hungry for news. Despite competition from TV, radio, and the web, Gazzetta has a loyal following, particularly those keen to catch up on the pagelle, a rating system ranking a player's performance during a match, and whose score has repercussions off the pitch. Gazzetta staff writer Luca Tidelli.
In the last 20 years, our way to work has changed even because of the fantasy football, that it's another thing Italians are obsessed of. So it changed because I think we are selling many copies, even because the people want to see the player ratings the day after the game, and the days before they want to see the lineups, because of course you bought some players and you want to know if your player is playing that game or not.
Given today's 24-hour news cycle, players on Twitter, and websites detailing gossip in the transfer market, Gazzetta's editors keep a step ahead of today's football-savvy public by looking for new ways to speak intelligently about the sport. Alex Frozio is an editor in the paper's football desk.
I think, first of all, we have to give something they can't find immediately. So let's make an example. If you watch a football match, everybody knows the result. So you have to give to the reader something more. What we changed is trying to give a tactical analysis of every player. For example, we introduced this column, which is called the analysis. Usually we analyze two players, how they played, their statistics, just like the Billy Bean story, you know, with passes complete and dribblings and take-ons. And that's something that you can't find actually on the internet, maybe also on TV, because you don't have the time to watch these kind of things. On the newspaper, you can stay there, read it, take your time, and this helps, I think, to understand what really happened.
Debate about what happened during a match is overheard everywhere in Italy. But Ferozio says the most popular place to catch up on Gazzetta is at the cafe.
Yeah, La Gazzetta dello Sport is a tradition in Italy. It's a kind of way to start the day. In fact, we are in almost every bar in Italy. We sell, I think, something like 70,000 copies every day in bars. You know, in Italy we have so many bars. So in almost every bar we have La Gazzetta. So you drink a coffee, read the newspaper. It's a tradition.
At Milan Cafe at Moscova 15, owner Giuseppe Negozio testifies to Gazzetta's popularity. His cafe's well-worn copy sits between patrons discussing Italy's World Cup chances.
Every morning we have many regulars that come here to read La Gazzetta, and they have a lot of fun commentating on it together. It's really a very Italian habit to commentate on sport at the bar every morning, and particularly with La Gazzetta. In a very fond way, we Italians also call the paper the pink, because it's been a part of the ritual of Italian breakfast for many, many years, especially on Mondays, when people want to know the results of the matches over the weekend.
With the Italian team off to a good start in Brazil, Gazzetta's editors hope for a repeat of 2006 triumph in Berlin, which saw the paper sell over 2.5 million copies following the final. For Monaco, in Milan, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
That was Monocle's correspondent in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, reporting on the Gazzetta dello Sport.
So Adam Toll and Ben Littleton are still with me. Just to turn to Gazzetta dello Sport for a moment, we were both sort of, we all three of us looked at this in a sort of warm way. And Adam, you talked about the sort of evening editions of the football papers, you know, back in Derby. There's something incredibly appealing about the dedicated football sort of newspaper. I find it intriguing that certain markets don't seem able to sustain that kind of coverage. And I take up the Gazzetta and I read it on the tube and try and convince people that I'm incredibly worldly wise and speak many languages and read these sorts of editions. Do you think there would be a marketplace for this, Ben, in other markets? Why, for example, why in the UK do we not have a football newspaper of this character? It seems like something that would be easy to sell and that people would be very keen to consume.
Well, as I said before, we don't. And I think it's because we have so many other newspapers and every newspaper wants its own section. And a lot of people buy or are loyal to a newspaper because of their sports section and in particular because of their writers. So because of Twitter, we tend to follow writers just as much as we follow newspapers. So everyone will have their favourite columnist or their favourite writer. And for example, my three favourite columnists would come from across three different newspapers, but I can still read all their stuff without actually buying any of the newspapers, which is a huge problem, exactly.
But what about as a writer then? Do you actually welcome that? Do you think that's the power shifting to where it should be? Or do you sort of reminisce for a day when it was all about, you know, the editor who'd sit there presiding over, you know, what made the grade or not?
Well, no, as a writer, I think, you know, it's obviously a good thing that writers, if they want, can become personalities and followed people themselves. I think that's good. And rather, you know, while it is a very competitive industry to get into and stay in, I think there is huge room for new people and new talents to come through, because if you are good enough, you can get the following that you want and get the audience you need. And I think that kind of open forum really is very new and exciting for young writers.
I guess a lot of those strong editorial voices in terms of running a tight ship on a sports desk, a lot of them, I guess, now maybe more drawn to the world of magazines. Maybe they feel there's a bit more opportunity to experiment something different, try a bit more creative expression. Adam, some of the titles that you've got in front of you there, talk to us about them and where you think they get the strength of their editorial voice from. I see you've got Colours there. Is that a classic example of a strong editorial voice, or is there something more dynamic that's on the page that draws you in? What do you make of Colours?
I was thinking how, you know, they've got so much flair on the pages, you know, there's little quirky mock Panini stickers that you sort of have to illustrate the rest of the issue with, you know, and there's even a shiny in there. And and then at the back, there's a booklet that talks about absurd yellow cards that people have got all sending off. And then it's actually die cut between a piece of card inserted in the magazine and the yellow card sticks out like it's in the referee's pocket. So there's all these little quirky little editorial moments in there, which I was thinking about, and only Colours could do that because it is a one-off, you know, it's a concept issue basically. And I feel like if we started to do little like niche quirky things like that, we'd become really tiresome quite quickly. But I guess that Colours will be moving on to the next subject, the next issue, and that's part of their charm, I guess.
It's pretty charming. It's a lovely thing. It's a lovely thing to hold. Look at that yellow card. I might brandish that later if anyone oversteps the mark. Ben, I wonder if you're sort of talking to editors and dealing with particular commissions, so they're looking at you or you've pitched them something, how sort of aware are you of the peculiarities, if you like, of their individual editorial approaches? Do you try and let your voice be the only thing that you focus on? Or is it a risk, I guess, for a writer to try and specifically tailor what they want to say to what they perceive their audience to be?
Well, this is one of the problems also that journalists have at the moment, because access is so difficult. If you are going to do an interview with a player, there can only really be one line on it, and that has to be positive. So you can't really have anything negative, because otherwise you don't get the access in the future. So that makes it quite difficult to write interesting pieces, more of a challenge, which is why the long form writing you see in the Blizzard or the Wright Thompson trips to Uruguay, where the story is actually the story rather than the interview and the quotes, because quotes in general from players tend to be the blandest thing in the interview process. It's the stuff around the players. So that is a big challenge. And the challenge for writers is to make the player sound interesting, even though you've got half an hour of quotes, which are essentially quite boring.
Just before we finish, Adam, I want to ask you about the Green Soccer Journal new issue, the sort of World Cup one, the Iker Casillas on the cover. We talked a little bit before, actually, when you came onto the programme about the sort of evolution of the magazine. Just bring us briefly up to speed then. Where do you think you've got to? You talked a bit about the structure and some other small changes. How do you feel in terms of the ongoing creative process, if you like? Do you quite like the fact that actually it's an ever-shifting surface?
I think it just has to happen because we dealt with different issues every single day and you know, the reason we actually go quarterly now rather than biannual, and that's because there is so much information coming from the sports brands who we collaborate with daily. An issue that came out biannually just, you know, it wasn't frequent enough for them. There's so much content there that they allow us to be involved with that most of the time we were dormant. We don't have an efficient website when it comes to news, when it comes to profiling players. It's just acting as a tool to sell the magazine. So the best we could do in the position that we're in right now is to try and make the magazine more frequent.
Sorry, there is a confidence about the Green Soccer Journal because we're talking about having one image and one name on the cover of titles like the Wall Street Journal did with Neymar. And Adam is too modest to say so, but this issue of the Green has Iker Casillas as the main cover image and the only cover line. But inside you have exclusives with Johan Cruyff, Phil Jagielka, Per Mertesacker, Victor Moses, Pablo Almeida, who scored a goal for Colombia. All these guys, and yet they're not on the cover. So that shows that there is some kind of confidence in their title and their content, just to say, well, we've got brilliant content here, amazing access to people, but we're only going to tell you about Casillas on the cover.
I like it. And it's all about the primacy of print, which is what we're all about here on The Stack. Adam Toll with his new edition of the Green Soccer Journal in hand, and Ben Littleton, thank you both very much indeed for joining us here on the programme.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this 95th edition of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. My special thanks to Adam Toll and Ben Littleton, to our producer, David Pleasant, and our studio managers, Chris Chauvers and Claire Urban. If you have any comments or queries, as ever, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And remember, we'll be back at the very same time next Saturday. Of course, you can always listen again at monocle.com via iTunes and on SoundCloud. But for now, until next time, it's goodbye from me.